We've been trying to figure out the relationship between church and state in this country since Europeans first arrived. And Mark Hillenbeck is fascinated with the history of church and state. Next semester, he'll lead an Honors College signature seminar about the subject at the University of Arkansas. Hillenbeck has been on the U of A law faculty since 1998, and there he teaches courses on the Constitution, the First Amendment, and American constitutional history. While the seminar isn't until 2020 and is for students in the Honors College, the public has a chance to hear him give a free preview lecture Wednesday at 5:15 p.m. in the Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. Recently, Mark Hillenbeck came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss church and state. He says there are distinct challenges for coming to a consensus about that relationship.
Everybody's conception of the proper relationship of church and state grows out of what they grew up with. No matter how you feel about other aspects of life or the government or Constitution, every single person has a position on religion. You have it. You have it in various degrees. You have it in various types, or you don't. And so it's intensely personal, and it's intensely local. And the problem is that we have a Constitution that is not put in place to structure local relationships. It's put in place to structure a national polity and to set up some sort of relationship between government and private institutions with a preferred position. There is no doubt of it, a preferred position for religion.
Has the countries, and since everyone has their own opinion or their own boundaries, but have things changed over time?
That's the second complicating factor. One of the founding myths, we've got the Doughty Pilgrims coming across the Atlantic, actually from Holland, not from England, because they had to flee England. Why did they flee England? The established church. So they come to America to establish religious freedom. And what did they immediately do? They established a church. They created a structure that mirrored the one they fled in England. And if you go back and look at the time the Constitution was framed, at least 9 and arguably 11 of the original 13 states all had established religions. Probably the most liberal one was in Massachusetts, ironically, where it was local option. If you lived in Plymouth, it could be Church X. If you lived in Salem, Church Y. But they replicated exactly what they decided to flee. The second complicating historical factor is that in 1791, when the First Amendment is ratified, this nation is virtually universally Christian. Religious tolerance meant, okay, you're a X, an Episcopalian. I'm a Lutheran. I'll put up with you. But of course, then there was Maryland with those troublesome Catholics.
Right, right.
And that has been the challenge. The evolution of the government and the court's conception of church and state has been deeply stressed by the diversification of the nation. Once you start getting immigration in the late 19th century, and in particular when you start getting it from places other than Europe, even Eastern Europe, you start getting it from around the world, you start to bring in a whole raft of religious beliefs and systems that, shall we say, mainstream Christians look at as you cannot be serious. This cannot possibly be religion. At the same time, the overwhelmingly Christian population in the United States, especially in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, are testing the boundaries of what they can get away with in terms of placing either religion in public life or getting public support for religious activity. And that's when the Supreme Court starts to enter with a vengeance and things get messy.
And that's in the, 1950?
Begins in 1947 with a case involving riding the bus to school.
Okay.
A rather harmless program. I have absolutely no quarrel with the notion that if you're going to provide money so people can attend private schools, you don't exclude the people going to religious schools. That's outright discrimination. What happens is in New Jersey, the Catholics, and most private education back then was Catholic, had the savvy to pass a measure that said any private accredited school. And so what the Supreme Court said is this is not a help religion matter. This is a help public education matter, the Everson case. Once Everson comes down 5-4, then they start pushing the boundaries. We got this. Let's see what we can get next. And there's a whole series of cases in the 50s and 60s that lead us to where we are today.
All right. So self-referential. We all have our own opinions. We've changed since the first Europeans got here. What's the third challenge?
The court.
Oh, wow.
Deeply fractured. I mean, ever since 5-4, very few of the key religion clause decisions, be they establishment or free exercise, which we haven't even talked about yet, are 8-1, 9-0, 7-2. Virtually all of them are 6-3 with concurrences or 5-4. It's divided. They cannot agree. And it's been a continuing struggle to try and make sense of what they've been doing.
Is there also just a challenge sometimes with defining what we mean by church and what we mean by state?
Oh, what we mean by our religion.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a guy who started this thing called the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
You'll occasionally see the bumper stickers.
In Kansas. He boiled for our sins. People hear that. And he did it for political reasons. He was contesting the state of Kansas in its devotion to creationism. So there was no doubt it was a parody. Under Supreme Court doctrine, you could, in fact, establish a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. All it needs to do is have the hallmarks of what we recognize as religion. It sounds weird to people. Perhaps the best example is a case that was actually litigated to the Supreme Court involving the Santerians. It's a Caribbean, people would call it a cult, not a religion. But instead of little unleavened wafers and thimbles of grape juice or wine, they sacrifice animals, little bunnies, little rabbits. City of Hialeah, Florida was horrified. And they passed a statute, a local measure that was clearly targeted to drive them out. And the Supreme Court, to its credit, said, this is a religion. This is entitled to the protection of the Constitution. But you raise the Santerians or the Spaghetti Monsters or any number of other religions, even in some quarters in some portions of this nation, Islam. And people go, no, that can't possibly be a religion. And that makes it even more fun.
And then what about definition of state? I mean, that's school, that's city council meetings, that's...
It's any... And this is one of the ironies. If you look at the text of the Constitution, there's a textualist argument that did not get traction. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. It does not say make no law establishing religion. What happens with Everson is they make it establishing religion. If you look at the landscape in 1791, there is a very powerful argument that what the Constitution was saying is to Congress, you keep your hands off of religion. It's a local matter. Remember what I said earlier. Most of the states had established churches. I think a respectable historical textual argument can be made. Congress could not then pass a statute saying Alabama, Massachusetts, Arkansas, you can't have an official state religion.
I think one thing where lay people might get confused or think we know what we're talking about and don't is, well, it'll just be fair. We can put up the Ten Commandments, and then if you want to bring something from the Quran or if you want to bring something from the Spaghetti Monster, that can go up too. It'll just be everybody.
Except that then the governments fight it tooth and nail. That's what's been going on down at the state capitol, the Baphomet, people trying to get the monument down there.
Baphomet, this allegedly satanic, probably tongue-in-cheek figure.
I'm not sure it completely asserted as tongue-in-cheek, but two or three other cases in Arkansas where traditionally they had the nativity scene on the courthouse lawn. Along come the troublemakers from the ACLU. So then what the local locality does is rent a portion of the courthouse lawn to a private organization in an attempt to make it look like, no, this isn't us, this is a private entity. And the court, the district court, to its credit, saw through that. But it's thing after thing after thing, because what are you basically appealing to? You're appealing to majority sentiment. Circle right back where we started. This is what makes this area so difficult, because people deeply feel this. And they, I don't doubt there's most of them. There's some I do. I don't doubt their sincerity. They are deeply offended. Why can't I have my God, whatever that God might be, part of my government and part of my life in that manner? I don't understand. Wasn't this nation founded on religious freedom? And my freedom to express myself should be recognized by my government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to have a crucifix around my neck and I work at a courthouse or a burqa or a yarmulke. That's fine.
Depends.
I love depends.
It depends on If you can't do it if it's part of a uniform. Police officers have tried that. They've got that.
Or a football uniform or something.
You can't do it in circumstances where it looks like what you're doing is imposing your view on people. So you've got to be careful how you do it. Can you wear the crucifix or the lapel pin? Probably. Can you even have perhaps that in your office? Probably. But you got to watch what you say. You've got to watch how you counsel. There's a very, very fun case decided in the Eighth Circuit by one of my all-time favorite people, Buzz Arnold, the Arkansan Good and True, where this guy was he was a counselor on welfare benefits, and what he wanted to do was to instruct people in the proper way to get a Christian view of whether you should have welfare. Can't do that. On the other hand, they couldn't keep him from keeping a Bible in the drawer on his desk so long as he read it before work hours. Then there's Roy Moore. People don't remember that he got his start as a trial court judge in the backwoods of Alabama with the Ten Commandments on the wall and praying with every jury before they went out to deliberate. And when the ACLU said you couldn't do that, that's what got him elected Chief Justice of Alabama.
So let's say I'm a judge and I want the 12 jurors to consider the weight of their responsibility. Now, I can't lead them in a specific denominational prayer. Can I ask them just to take a moment and think?
You do that as part of the charge of the jury. Okay. Here is the law. Here are the facts. Think about it.
Okay.
You don't bring in anything else.
Right.
Hopefully.
Same with high school football games. You've got prayers. The players say, we want to have a prayer. They huddle. It's not over the public address system. Still, if it's on a high school field, public school, whatever student is leading that shouldn't lead it in one denomination, should he or she?
No.
Because you could be isolating or—
And part of it comes out of the history of the locality. So what happens now is the way you play the game is you try and make it look like it's purely private speech. But if it's purely private speech in a district or school system where historically they did it as an official policy— and now what they're doing is sort of farming it out, then you can get into difficulties. The proverbial bottom line is if we are going to respect the increasing diversity of the nation, we should have enough respect for everybody else to say, does this really belong here? Do we really need this overt kind of conduct?
And by saying you can't do that specifically isn't to denigrate your particular religion. It's just to say we're respecting everyone.
Yeah.
So inclusion through, not exclusion.
Well,
but the
irony here is we haven't talked about free exercise because that's the second part of the church and state thing. Congress shall make no law respecting establishment nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In 1878, famous case, Reynolds, the Supreme Court was confronted with the state of Utah, which had a few quaint customs, including plural marriage. And Utah was told, no plural marriage, can't come into union with that. And in Reynolds, the court said, you're absolutely free to believe that you have a moral obligation or you will suffer eternal damnation to have multiple marriage. You simply can't act on it. Belief-conduct dichotomy. That worked because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was a fringe Christian religion in the 1870s and remained so for much of our history. Once we began to treat free exercise as a fundamental right and give it heightened protection and the nation got more diverse, problems arose. So in 1989, we get a new case involving Native Americans in Oregon. Once or twice a year, under carefully controlled circumstances, as part of their religion, they wanted to ingest peyote. Oregon said, no can do if you want unemployment benefits. Mm. Supreme Court, on its own, this issue was not briefed, resurrected belief conduct as part of the federal free exercise guarantee. You're absolutely free to believe. You are not free to act. Well, lots of us, including me, reacted with horror. We thought, this is bad. But as the nation became more and more diverse and we began to get more and more religions from all around the place coming in with all sorts of religious commands that ran counter to accepted criminal and civil prescriptions, it began to look like this wasn't necessarily all that bad a rule in terms of at what point do you say we have always treated this as an act you cannot undertake. Now you're telling me we're going to let you undertake it simply because it's part of this religious system. And it poses special problems. I mean, that is the underlying problem with Mr. The Baker in Colorado, the masterpiece cake thing.
Right.
In terms of his sincere belief that he's not going to bake cakes for same-sex marriages and the notion that, sorry, we have a non-discrimination law that that protects this group of people. One of the interesting things was during the 50s and 60s, litigating religions that claimed that as part of their religious system, they had a religious obligation and right to discriminate against African Americans. Right. And there's some, it's an interesting, I studied this for an article I wrote. The courts were deeply, deeply troubled by this. And some courts, not many, to their credit, recognized that this was in fact a religion and it was in fact a religious belief, but then elided their way around it. But the religious belief systems and the things that are forbidden by religions are just, they're vast.
Well, you see it with the morning after pill or contraceptives. Mm-hmm. Someone might say, I don't want to hand out or offer these prescriptions because it goes against my belief system.
That's right. And that was one of, that was a case that came to the court where they denied cert. They did not hear the case, prompting a relatively vigorous dissent from the denial of cert. There are lots of these issues that are lurking on the horizons. And one of the fun things I did is I said, okay, let's look at all these religions. What do religions forbid? I did not know that both in a number of religious systems, including in the Christian Bible, the Jewish Bible, and the Quran, tattoo, mm-hmm. forbidden. Okay, can I refute? Now, then I found a statistic that said 45% of the adult population between 18 and 65 have ink.
45%?
Wow. I hope that's not true, but that's just me, old fuddy-duddy about it.
Right.
But what happens when if you walk into a department store or you walk into a restaurant, you've got ink, and they refuse to serve you?
As a restaurant owner, I'm sorry. That's defacing the body.
Mm-hmm. All sorts of interesting things.
This isn't going to go away, is it?
No.
I mean, there's a good chance that you and I don't know all of the issues that 20 years from now will be involved in this, but we know there will be.
And we know there will be because what happens is, as I said earlier, the court rules. People, so to speak, bow their heads, and then they get on doing what they want to do.
Yeah.
And we litigate it, and we litigate it, and we litigate it. I want you to confront this and confront it from two perspectives. What do you believe and why? Why does it structure your life? And then what do other people believe and why do they believe it? And when those things collide, how should we respond appropriately? Should we respond appropriately with tolerance and respect, or should we respond by saying, excuse me, I want my government to adopt my view and a pox upon yours? They don't say a pox upon yours, but that's the feeling that you get. Justice Ginsburg expressed it very eloquently in her dissent in the Bladensburg case in terms of, yes, you and you think this. There are others who think otherwise. And what about them?
Mark Killenbeck is a law professor at the University of Arkansas School of Law, and he will deliver a free public lecture about church and state Wednesday at 5:15 in Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. He'll lead an Honors College signature seminar on church and state in the spring 2020 semester.